This is CliffCentral.com.
This is Disrupt with Mpumi Club, powered by T-Systems.
Good morning and welcome again to Disrupt with Mpumi Nhlapho. Thank you for joining us on the show again. If you are with us for the first time on this show, we focus on really speaking to industry leaders, captains of industry and influential people around how this technology evolving world is impacting our lives, our society. And we really look at it from very different angles and perspectives. We've got another very interesting insight that we'll get today from our guest, who I'll introduce a little bit later on in the show. With me today, joining me once again, Dumi Lobela. Dumi, how are you?
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. We're very happy to have you back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back. It's been a while.
Talking about what's happening and what's trending,
yes,
within the technology and business arena. I know there's three key areas we're going to look at today.
Exciting areas.
Yes, before we talk to our guest.
Yes.
And just to give you a little bit of a taste of who our guest is for the show today, she's a successful young woman. She's the founder of, a founding and member of Black Women in Science. She has been identified as the Mail and Guardian Young South Africans under the education sector in 2016, the top 200. She is a master's degree graduate in applied environmental science, and she's also pursuing a PhD in the Global Change at the Global Change Institute of Wits University. And we're going to talk about the work that she's doing, the research she's doing, and how that's going to shape and change things like, you know, sustainability of the environment, things like food security, and really understanding how technology starts to play a role in that space. But before we get to that, Dumi, so what's been happening over the last couple of weeks from a technology and disruption perspective that you picked up?
Oh, exciting things, exciting things. First up, we're going to be talking about the taxi industry. And we know the taxi industry, how we feel about that as Joburgers, right?
Yes.
Well, they have launched a transport management technology platform, right? It's called AfterRobot. This allows commuters, basically, to know where their taxi is and to actually pre-order a taxi.
Okay. So it sounds like something
it's an Uber. Yes. Okay. It's an Uber, but for the taxi, minibus taxi industry.
Okay, for the minibus taxi
industry. Yes.
Who's launched this?
Okay, so it's the Johannesburg Southern Suburbs Taxi Association.
Okay, so it's a taxi association, yes, that have launched their own.
Yes, they have launched their own technology platform.
Fantastic.
Yes, basically this allows users to basically, as a commuter, right, instead of waking up at 4 a.m., 3 a.m. to go stop get a taxi at some spot, I can actually pre-order it on this mobile platform.
Okay.
From my mobile device, wherever I book it from.
Okay.
On my mobile device. And then at the particular time where I said I want that taxi to be there, it will be there. So instead of me waking up earlier, I can wake up at my normal time and the taxi will find me at my normal spot. So again, it's like an Uber. However, this also helps monitoring of taxis. So they will have devices, right, on taxis. Basically, taxi owners can track where their taxis are at any particular time.
Okay. Right? Which is quite nice, because I think, yep, I mean, I know from my time when I used to catch taxis as a means of transport, the biggest thing was just the uncertainty.
Yes.
You know, so one, you could get there is a taxi, but it's going to take an hour to get full.
Yeah, you know? So you don't know.
You don't know. Two, you could get there aren't any taxis and you wait an hour for one to arrive. So is this attempting to deal with that uncertainty and unpredictability?
Yes, the inefficiencies and to create new routes. So a lot of the taxi drivers or taxi associations stick to certain routes, right?
Yes.
So this will help them to know where their commuters are. So okay, if you know that there's a particular route where there are a lot of people that are asking for the taxi, then you can create a route along that area.
Very
so this is exciting stuff. So it will be installed in 10,000 vehicles, right? 4,000 owners and 50,000 commuters will be able to use this technology. It is awesome, I think, for me.
Fantastic.
However, right? I mean, we know the minibus taxi industries and how it operates, right?
Mm.
So people are questioning, so how is this going to be impacting the Uber service, right? What is the difference between this minibus taxi application or technology platform versus the Uber? Because it does exactly the same thing.
Okay.
Number one, it's price. Right. So taxis are still relatively cheaper than your Ubers. So the people that can afford taxis, actually it affects them the most, right? Not for us, unless you want to catch a taxi. I mean, some of us, maybe we can't afford these Ubers and we think, okay, this is a greater platform to actually get where I need to go and to arrive on time. I mean, we've heard so many stories of people who have been late for interviews, late for meetings because of the unpredictability, like you said, of the routes. So it will also help in that. Number two, it will help taxi owners track their taxis, right? Their vehicles. So a lot of the times they're complaining now. I mean, I was even heard stories a couple of days ago of taxi drivers who left because they were disgruntled, left their taxis somewhere, and then the owner had to just run around and find them. Okay. So this actually helps the taxi associations to track where their vehicles are at any given point in time.
Okay.
So you basically can report back and say, in these routes, because obviously with the taxi industry as well, they're fighting over routes. Mm. You can actually prove that my taxis were not on your route. They were here. So with a lot of taxi violence right now, that is what is happening. They're actually fighting for routes because obviously it's more money.
Okay.
So those are the things. So the visionary behind this is Obakeng Morabedi Matlhoko. Call him Obi. So he's the guy that actually created this platform. It was launched last week and it will be used over the next, obviously deployed over the next couple of months.
Okay.
The biggest thing I think for me is the safety for the taxis, right? So you can deploy this technology, great. But how safe is it? Actually, can it be hacked? So for instance, I book a taxi 4 a.m. and I say I'm going to be at this designated spot at 4 a.m. I'm a woman, right? And I'm alone. How do I trust that this taxi is actually the one that I ordered? So there's still those things that, you know, need to be worked around to say, how safe am I to actually book a taxi online on my mobile device? Okay. But it's still great stuff nonetheless.
I think it's fantastic. It's quite, I mean, it's also bringing some transparency, bringing some progression into the industry. So we like that.
I love it. On to our next top story, sensors. We love sensors, right? We love stats essay, right?
No. The knock on the door.
No, we don't. So sensors have developed a technology platform as well, right? To basically collect stats, right? So what they've done before, obviously, you know, they would knock on your door, be like, okay, how many people do you have in this house? Like, how long have you lived here? Surnames, take all your details and take forever, and you'll have these people running around, right? Security perspective, it was also a big issue because you found that a lot of the time when census took place, there were a lot of people who were robbed, right? And it was not great. So now, well, still the same thing. It hasn't changed much. However, Stats SA have announced that they are basically going electronic, right? They are going to be conducting census in 2021 using tablets, using multiple platforms, basically technology platforms that will collect the data, obviously, and basically distribute the data and have quick access to the data, obviously, for the powers that be, the stakeholders, for them to know easily when this person was at a particular house, and what the information of those people in that house will be uploaded quickly and efficiently. That is great for us, right? However, so whichever story I have, I always have the other side, right? So this is great, right?
Yes.
Less paper, right? So a lot of people will, you know, be experiencing less paper. So it's great, right?
Yes.
So you don't have to go through multiple pages. However, we still have 150,000 people that are going to be going to houses with tablets. What problem does that pose?
150,000 tablets running around. I mean, it's a big cost. If it's one or two, it's manageable. But I mean, at those numbers, it becomes a huge challenge.
Yeah, so it's a risk. Theft, right?
Yes.
So if I go, and I know, we all know census, it will be happening because there'll be adverts everywhere. And I know there'll be people wearing t-shirts who have tablets, right? So I can easily create a syndicate where I target these people, right? Yeah. So how is the safety of these people going to be assured, right? And the safety of the people that are in those houses that will be participating in the census. Number two, is it really practical to have 165,000, by the way, tablets that will be bought, but they'll be having 150,000 field workers that will be going around house to house. But is it really practical to have a tablet, right? A customized tablet that is with customized applications on it.
Yes.
Every 10 years. So after the census, then what's going to happen to these tablets, right? 10 years later, unless they're planning to do something special, they haven't actually announced what they're going to be doing with these tablets afterwards. But unless they're going to be doing something productive and special with these tablets after the fact, it's actually a waste of money. You could create actually multiple platforms, right? You were talking about having, use your own device, right? So push SMSs, push emails, whatever, to people, track who has responded, and maybe only go to those houses where people haven't responded, right? You can easily track from a location perspective who answered and when, right? So you can apply multiple technologies to do this. But for me, it's not a practical exercise. They are predicting that it's going to cost $3.4 billion. Right, to actually launch this electronic census.
It's big money.
It's big money. However, Treasury have only allocated about $1 billion, right, over the next 3 years for StatsSA to actually do this. So it's going to actually be interesting how they capitalize. Also, for me, can't you capitalize on your current platform? StatsSA already has infrastructure, technology infrastructure in play. They don't have to now go create another data center. They don't have to create another platform where they actually do this. Use what you're using right now,
yes,
and maybe the money will come down.
Yes.
Right? Actually, it
yes.
will come down, right?
Yeah.
Be creative. There's technology that does so many things. Be creative on that. So I'm not too, I'm happy. I'm great. No more paper. We're saving going green. However, in terms of the practicality of this, maybe not so great.
Yeah, so I think the message there is really that they need to consider how they leverage, like you said, existing technology.
Yep.
And, you know, 2021 is a long time in the technology world. So
it
even
is.
The investments or ideas, concepts they've got now might not be so relevant by the time we get to that point. So they just need to be cognizant.
I think cognizant, but we need influencers as well. I think they need to be a committee. I mean, our dear president was announcing that there will be actually a committee, a digital committee, right? You need to consult these committees and say in the next 3 years, a lot, like you say, will be happening.
Yes.
Why don't you evolve with it? Instead of saying we're going to have these tablets, maybe there's something in the next 2 years that will actually come up that will be more beneficial to you.
Lower cost.
Lower cost,
yes,
in that area. And I'm hoping that these tablets will be locally manufactured. I'm hoping that these tablets will be bought from a local supplier and a local company, because I'm all for buy local, buy black.
Okay.
Yes.
Our third story.
Our third story, Intel. Intel is in trouble. Okay, so Intel basically had flaws on their chips, right? And they didn't inform the US government. And the US government is not happy because they're saying, how could you not tell us something so crucial and so critical? Because then we would be able to basically do something to or prepare ourselves for this. So Intel are saying that, no, we didn't actually have to tell you because it didn't actually compromise anyone. Nothing was hacked. Nobody, like nothing was damaged. Mm. So we actually didn't have to. So the US government officials, right, were informed of the flaws when they went public. However, Alphabet informed Intel over 6 months ago of these flaws.
Of the vulnerabilities, yes.
Yes, of the vulnerabilities on these chips, right? Because they were using these chips for their applications and development in at Google. So, but what happened is that once they found these flaws, they actually informed them. They said, we're giving you 90 days to sort this out and you can inform whoever you needed to inform. And they didn't, right? And now Google are saying, but it's not our job. We told them to fix it and then we did what we needed to do. So right now, it's going through the legal process back and forth where the United States Computer Emergency Readiness Team, gosh, USSCERT, right, are basically collecting reports. So from AMD, Google, Alphabet regarding this to say, you have exposed us. Because you know the US are very finicky when it comes to cybersecurity and IT security.
As we all should be, yeah.
As we all should, but they are worse. Mm. I think we know as the First Nation, we know how they feel about such security flaws or being compromised from a security perspective. So they basically, at this point, are saying that they need to account, right? So everybody who is basically like your Microsoft, so everybody must account. Amazon was also part of this. So everybody must account about what happened and what is the process moving forward. Should they inform? And should they inform the authorities? And if they don't inform the authorities, what are the consequences that come out of that? So it was it's actually a big story pending. The Google guys, Alphabet, they're submitting reports and everybody's reviewing it to say, what do we do moving forward? But the US authorities are saying, if there's any company, especially if you're multinational, especially if you're manufacturing, creating chips, things that manufacturers use and things that will be used in applications and hardware
across the spectrum,
yeah, we need to know about it, right? We don't want to be like the AU, finding out afterwards that there were things that were in these chips that we didn't actually know about. Yes. So for me, I think it's this story is not going in anywhere anytime soon. I think that we will see a lot of developments with regards to them coming up with regulations, legislation that dictates what should happen if you know. Because obviously Intel was protecting their brand, right?
Yes.
Think about it.
Yes.
You are a chip manufacturer, right? And it's
a stalwart, industry established for many years.
Yes, and you tell people, oh, listen, we've got a flaw. See, they're not like cars. They're not going to recall, right?
Yeah.
So all they're going to do, they're going to come up with a patch, or they're going to come up with something that basically helps, you know, not to make sure that that flaw actually compromises a lot of manufacturers or compromises a lot of systems.
Mm.
But right now, it's nobody actually knows the extent to which this has affected. And obviously, you don't want to know. I if I was Intel, I wouldn't tell people as well.
But I think, you know, it goes back to a similar case we had with Google when they were, you know, when they were hacked and they had a ransomware attack.
Yes.
And eventually they paid the ransom and the data was released. You know, there was, I think, credit card details and user information. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, the biggest issue that people had was the lack of transparency. So the fact that you can be compromised or that your systems can be vulnerable, I think we accept that the world we live in today, there are people that make a career of hacking and you know, and compromising systems. I think the bigger issue here for Intel is really about being transparent, you know, being forthcoming with information so that people then are aware and they can make decisions about how they handle that. You know, that's probably for me the bigger consideration, broadly even beyond Intel, for any company that enters this digital arena, is that when you do have these compromises of people's data and information, how you respond to that in terms of, you know, letting people know. I mean, it's a simple thing. Alerting people, allowing them to prepare themselves.
So they're saying they informed their constituents, right? Their stakeholders.
Yeah.
The ones that they actually manufacture chips for. They don't need to inform anybody else. Why should they inform the public?
Yeah.
It's their defense. If I inform Microsoft and Microsoft know, why should I inform anybody else?
It's great. It's a gray area.
Gray area.
So we'll see that one evolving.
Yes, we will. So that's it for our top stories for this morning.
Thank you very much, Dumi. We will now then turn the agenda to our guest for today, who's been listening very attentively as Dumi's been speaking. Before we get into the discussion, Ndoni, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Very
thank
well.
You
thank
so
you for joining
for
us, Ndoni Mchunu. You're a PhD candidate. Mm-hmm. You've completed your master's degree. You're a professional scientist, as you said earlier. why do you pursue this career of all the things you could have done? How did you get to be in the space where you're now 3 years into your PhD?
Mm. So I'd love to say that it's something that I planned, and it's not. And I think that's why I'm passionate about it as well.
Okay.
Because as I've grown into it and as I've fallen into it in inverted commas, it's actually shown me the opportunities that I have as a black female in this industry. So I fell into it. I grew up in KZN, and KwaZulu-Natal is a really great agricultural green place. And I fell in love with the place. I fell in love with the environment. I fell in love with the concept of the environment. And then I did my undergrad in it. But did I plan and walk out of life saying from undergrad, I'm going to come out with a PhD? No. So that's why.
You've grown into it.
Yeah, you grow into it.
Okay. And your specific area of focus is applied environmental science.
Mm.
And when I looked it up, it spoke about, you know, the intersect between the environment, between sustainability and the practices and disciplines that kind of study that and how we maintain it. Your areas of focus within applied environmental science, where do you spend most of your time researching?
Mm. So currently I'm focusing on food security, agriculture and climate change.
Okay.
That is my focus for my PhD.
Okay.
Even in my undergrad, or rather in my master's, I focused on still agriculture, but I was just looking at remote sensing, satellite imagery, and how we can use satellite imagery in using it as a tool for an early warning system for our farmers.
Okay.
Right now, I am looking at ecological systems and looking at how we can incorporate the methods of ecology with agriculture. And the goal at the end of the day is to make sure that our farmers are food secure.
Okay. Yeah. So I want to then take a step back and break it down, because we're not all PhD candidates. So quite simply, can you just give me in a nutshell, applied environmental science, what is it that your fellow scientists attempt to achieve within that space?
So there's a lot of avenues that you can take in environmental science. Earlier we were speaking about water.
Yes.
Some people can specialize in water and how we can be more sustainable with the use of water, or how can we sanitize our water, or whatever the case may be in the water issues.
Yes.
In terms of agriculture, you can focus on different farming systems, or looking at a certain disease that has broken out into the farming system, or look into how do we make our country more food secure. So applied environmental science is looking at different streams of the environment, be it water, be it energy, be it food.
Okay.
And how can we then apply our science and our skills in making sure that we sustain these resources, or that these resources don't become in harm from human interaction or from industrial interaction or from science itself.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we speak about food security. My assumption then is that there's a risk inherent in the availability of food, and it's an area that clearly requires a lot of focus and attention.
Mm.
Where are we now? So where are we coming from, and why do we believe there's a risk in terms of the sustainability of food supply?
Mm. So when I did my master's study, it was during the drought. I don't know if you remember, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, there was an extreme drought that left our farmers in such debt in terms of their produce and their food security and just food availability in its whole. So with the change in climate and with development, so first of all, it's population. The population is growing at a greater rate right now. People are moving into urban areas. People are no longer practicing farming in their rural areas. People are moving into cities. So there's a lot of dynamics now that are happening in the world in saying that with the increase of population, how do we ensure that we have food security? At the same time, as the population is growing, that means more land is being used for housing, more land is being used for industrial development because people need jobs.
Mm.
So how do we manage that kind of shift that's happening right now? So you see that as we increasing in developing our land, but now what is going to happen to the land that we need to grow our food?
Yes.
So those are the two dynamics that we have. And that's where I'm focusing on my PhD, is that with these changes in these demands in life, with food security, how do we manage that? So on top of that, climate change, environmental change, you're seeing that there's a lot of extreme weather events that are happening.
Yes.
It rains, yes, but it's now hailing more.
Mm.
And you ask yourself, what does that do? You see that summer is not as hot as it should be. So how do we kind of understand these changes in the environment, and how do we make sure that we're ready for them? That's why we need to study environmental sciences.
Okay, I'm with you. I'm kind of sitting and I'm thinking, there's a school of thought that says we need to change the way we engage the earth so that we can mitigate the change in the climate.
Mm.
What I'm hearing from you is that you've kind of accepted that it's changing, and it's how do we engage that?
Mm.
How do you reconcile the two?
So it is all about awareness, and it is all about acceptance in terms of individuals and in terms of leaders.
Okay.
So if the environment is changing, and you can see that a typical case is Cape Town right now with the water challenge that they have going on.
Yeah.
As a leader and as individuals, that is something that you have to accept, that it's changing.
Yes.
So now if you don't accept it, that's where we start having problems, and that's where we start having day zeros. And that's where you start seeing that people are now being in a panic on how do we now, what is this environment and how do you do that? So I'd say how do we merge the two is, first of all, awareness, making the study of environmental science as a way of informing policy and informing leaders in how do they decide when they're developing a certain building, or when they are deciding to install a water sanitation project. So how do we... So that is the way that we can actually kind of make environmental science and merging the two sectors of having these changes and accepting these changes, but at the same time making people aware, making leaders aware, and making society change their habits in how they communicate or how they interact with the environment.
Mm. Do you believe that we can have significant impact on changing the rate at which the climate is degrading? So is that an area? I know it's not your particular area of focus. I mean, you're more on the other side of that coin. But in your opinion, being an expert in the field, is I mean, do we have the ability to change it? Because I've heard you know, where they talk about, well, it was inevitable, it's going to happen. And there's the other side that says, no, it's greenhouse emissions and all the stuff that we're doing as human beings. Where do you sit on that?
Yeah, there's definitely we can do something about it. So it's the reality is that scientists are doing this research. They've been doing this research. We've got theses in libraries and universities of scientists qualifying with their PhDs, qualifying with their masters, focusing on these key challenges of food, water, energy.
Okay.
And now it's a matter of integrating these sectors. So research and innovation, and combining it with leadership and governance and policy, and combining it with normal individuals, with society. Those are the three legs that we kind of have to incorporate in making sure that we can combat the impacts of climate change. Is there technology to impact climate change? Yes, there is.
Okay.
Are there methods to make sure that the impacts of climate change aren't felt as hard or as cutthroat in business, in personal lives, as it is currently? There are methods and solutions. I think maybe scientists or the industry of science has not been taken seriously enough to say, what have you guys done on the ground and where are we currently, just in general?
Yes.
Not when a crisis happens, then we're reacting and we're all saying, we are all the water experts, there's no water.
Yes,
what are the scientists saying? And you've got water experts sitting in departments, just sitting, and you've got young, energetic, hydrological scientists that are sitting there, and you can use all of these minds in playing around with ideas. It's all about playing around. That's what research is. That's what innovation is. You play around with it. You give money and funding to these scientists and say, here's the issue. Here's what we are predicting. How do you solve this?
Mm,
you know, start doing that now and not waiting for a drama to happen. And then you call all the scientists and say, what's happening?
Yes.
You know what I mean? So
let me ask this question then. Given that we've had this burning platform, you know, so we had the droughts, you know, a couple of years back, and then we recently had the situation in the Western Cape with the droughts there. Have you seen now an impetus in terms of kind of attention and focus being placed on the scientists and the scientific fraternity to come up with solutions? Has that grown?
Yeah, it's grown, definitely. Well, in terms of the water problem in Cape Town, definitely the water scientists are more involved. In my department, my supervisor was and his colleagues were actually speaking about how day in and day out, they're getting calls around, what do we do? What's water? What is this? What's going on?
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Yes.
And then some of my colleagues in Cape Town who are doing water engineering, you can see the amount of attention they are getting. It's completely changed. Now you've got young PhD females who are now being asked, you know, write an article on what you think of the water crises. Come to a panel and discuss the water issues and how do we deal with these issues. The challenge then is, as a country, we can move to a research industry where scientists are telling us all these solutions, but there's still issues of development that we haven't dealt with. In saying that, how, now the water issue is highlighted because now everyone is out of water. However, they've had rural areas that have not had water for years.
And nothing has changed. Yeah.
So why was it not a concern? And I think that for me becomes it just shows it's just reactive. So when we solve it, I'm not convinced that they're going to say, let's carry on. You know, how about the person ohlala ekhayelisha and it does not have water access? That person should be a priority as much as the person who's staying at Camps Bay.
Absolutely.
So those are the issues that I have in terms of water developments and science and developments as a whole, that we need to prioritize it throughout the year, throughout individuals, throughout every situation, and not calm down.
Yeah, it should be part of a strategic plan we have for the
country.
Every day.
You know what I mean? I should be, or not even me, every scientist that's doing her PhD should be in every policy decision making or every new technology meeting, not sitting in your silo in your research office. No, the reason why you're doing this research is so that it's because you're researching it. You're trying to make sure that whoever said this is said it right, or I'm saying now this is how you can improve it. So how am I doing that and you're not even aware?
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? That for me is like, what's the point? So we've got to start now, because we've seen that at the end of the day, you call the scientists when there's a tragedy to figure it out. Of course, you need the business to invest in that idea, but you still need the foundation of the scientist who has the knowledge and says to you, this is what has been done, let's try this, it doesn't work, let's try that, and we find a solution.
And your focus now is on food security, and obviously there's a natural a link between availability, security of water, and security of food. But I want to focus now on the work that you're doing. You mentioned that specifically what you're researching is how diversifying the crops that farmers, small-scale farmers, are farming can enhance food security, and you're looking at different models of how that then creates a sustainable system for those farmers. Can you talk us through that?
So our farmers in sub-Saharan Africa, that's where my focus is, we've been practicing methods of diversification. So the majority of farmers in sub-Saharan Africa are small-scale farmers. This means between 2 hectares to 5 hectares, so not large plots.
Yes.
So with this whole changing need and demand of food security and development that's happening in our countries, we're seeing that a lot of people, there is a higher need to produce food. There's a higher need to have more investments in food production. The challenge is that with this higher need, you're seeing developed countries and large-scale farmers coming into the country and farming into this land because we have arable land.
Yes.
In London, it's snowing right now. It's freezing. That's not suitable for agriculture. We have warm environments. We have green environments. We have rainy weather. We have rich soils. So it makes our land more able to produce food production.
So now
how do we make sure that these methods that the farmers are using, diversification, can be used to impact the changes in the climate? So what diversification says is that we have different types of crop in one land, in one plot of land. So this means that some crops will be more resilient to the changes of climate than others. If you have spinach and potatoes, potatoes might be more resilient to the changes or to a warmer climate or to a colder climate. That means that you'll always have food, no matter what.
Okay.
So they're using these systems unaware. Like they just, it's just being done. So
yeah, if you have, that's what I know.
Yeah, if you so if you take tomatoes and you're just like, oh, there's a seed of tomato, let me put it here.
Yes.
There's spinach, let me put it here. There's no planning. So what we're trying to do is see what kind of genetic combinations can we have that are scientifically proven to make sure that you have this kind of food supply throughout the year. So you could find that, okay, fine, they might have, say, cabbage, spinach, and they're all there. So cabbage and spinach is from the same kind of species.
Yes.
We are trying to say, how does it become also nutrient to you as a person who's eating it? So you're not just eating one kind of vitamin or one kind of vegetable, but we're trying to say, have your potatoes, have your spinach, have your green, your reds, your tomatoes or whatever. Combine all of those and see how, if it actually works, does it actually work? Can we actually make sure that people are food secure no matter what the change in climate is, with these different combinations of food in one plot?
My assumption was that it's, you know, when I've been to, you know, kind of small garden farms, that if my assumption that people are already doing that. I'm trying to ascertain what becomes different that then suggests that we need to do some very advanced scientific studies around it.
So the challenge is nutrition, and also the challenge is production. So if you, they are doing it, but it's not necessarily proven that it is a method. So now once we prove it and say, okay, diversification is a method that can combat climate change, then we can start using that in informing policy and saying that, okay, guys, as leaders, here's a booklet that says to you, these are the different crops that you can plant in one plot of land. This is how much you can actually extensify your land in making sure that you can produce as much as you can.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I
so
see.
It's more detailed in saying it's not just a winging it kind of situation.
It's a much more deliberate.
It's a more deliberate thing now that we're saying, do it deliberately and it's going to work out for you. In that sense, also, it's a way of ensuring that if you increase your land, you can also sell more. You can also produce more for your yield and for your income and for your household. So it's not like, oh, this didn't work out, I wonder why. And then you start adapting into that pattern and saying, maybe spinach doesn't work out in this time of the year anymore. You know instantly from the get-go that this is, doesn't work out and this works out. So it's something that we are testing out, and it's something that I hope actually can inform
policy,
in the future.
And tell me, how are you going about doing this? I know you mentioned that part of, you know, some of the stats you're working with is 80,000 farmers and multiple crops. To talk us through, you know, how one goes about doing a PhD study of this nature.
Okay, so it's different. I don't know how other people are doing it, but for me, I'm going to be using, my supervisor is a systems analysis, ecosystems specialist.
Okay.
So he is, so we're trying to look at it at different angles, using different methods in proving the same thing,
okay,
kind of way. So we're not just using one method. So we're using satellite imagery, such as remote sensing. We have...
What is remote sensing? I know you mentioned it a bit earlier. Just explain it very
remote
quickly.
Sensing is satellites that are in space that take images, orbits around the Earth,
okay,
and they show landscapes across the world.
Okay.
So we are going to obviously zoom in into my study area.
Okay.
And see a bird's eye view. So it's almost like you're on a plane, mm-hmm, and you're taking pictures with your camera. That's basically what remote sensing is.
Okay.
So we're going to be looking at that and seeing. So we say that we are a diverse nation. Looking from a bird's eye view, can we see that in our landscapes using different remote sensing? Can we see that, okay, this farmer has changed his plot size into being blocks, into being circles?
I see.
Can we see that it's diagonal, vertical versus horizontal satellite imagery? So we're going to look at that first, and then we're going to look into statistical analysis because of the data set being so large that I have. And during that, you have to use methods like Python, like R, in predicting or in kind of showing us this is what's going on in the ground. And given these predictions with climate change predictions using weather data, climatic data, and using our food security data or our food data, predict that with these changes, this is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen in the next 20 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your focus, you said, is in Zambia at the moment.
Yeah, it's in Zambia.
What's the reason for choosing Zambia, and how is that going?
Zambia has large investments of large-scale farmers currently in their country.
Okay.
In terms of the agricultural practices, they do practice diversification more than how much we do in our country. So Zambia, with this, surely as soon as you see a country having all this kind of investments with large-scale farmers, it's interesting to see why the interest.
Why are
you interested here?
Yeah.
So we want to know why are they interested in this site, and also what are they doing that we can also adapt, because we can have the same kind of climate, same kind of soil structure and access to technology. So we're trying to see what they are doing and how can we implement it here, and how we can do kind of the same thing.
Yeah. Is it not economic policy, perhaps, that's just making it more accessible?
It could be that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And another thing is, with South Africa, it's a little messy right now, you know, to try and do land analysis and food security analysis. If when I was just in my data, just looking at ownership of land in their harvest surveys, a lot of the farmers have some kind of ownership in the land. So
yes,
history of South Africa plays a role into this kind of research. You can, it was easy for me to fall into a land policy debate in my study.
Okay.
But I wanted to really focus on agricultural production debate.
Okay.
So with South Africa and the whole land rights, and I was going to get swamped in. I know myself. I was just going to be like, we want the land. So I just wanted to, so it was wise for us to move into that kind of area.
Okay. Part of your research then also looks at the commercial sustainability within the system. And it's applied environmental science, so you're very much about the substance, right? But in this case, you know, looking at the commercial viability, why does that inform the work that you're doing?
It's very important, because what we're seeing is farmers want to move towards a place where they own their own business. They're no longer owned by a white farmer or by a commercial farmer. They want to own their own business.
Okay.
So for a farmer to move into that, we need to start understanding. And when I say we, I mean Africans need to start moving into that research, because once it's in your blood to be an African and it's in you, you also want to the best for that farmer.
Yes.
You see, so
yes,
that's why it's important that understanding the commercial side for me is very important, because I can't come up with these systems and say this is works, but how do you know it works if it's not feeding the farmer? You know, how do you know? It has to, at the end of the day, it's all about commercial. It's all about, where is your product going to end? How is it going to be used? How is your work going to be who's it going to feed your work? So the commercial side is very important for me personally, because I, after my PhD, I'd love to get into the commercial sector of farming, the business sector of farming. How do we make our farmers produce at a rate where the large scale farmer is producing? Or how do we make sure that their product is sold at spa and not sold at a small spaza only, but can be bought by big companies like Spar, Pick and Pay, Woolworths, and make sure that they are actually feeding into the supply chain system of farming, of food production.
Okay.
So it's very important to understand that in terms of in food security, because food security is not just about you eating, but it's also about your income. It's also about your sustainability as a household, as a family. So, and also these businesses are starting. How do they start? So do they get a loan? Do they get a grant? Are they funded for? Do they? It's very important, because then you're not growing. If you're working on a loan, you're not growing.
Okay.
So we have to understand these systems. It's very complex, but you have to kind of combine all of them.
And what are you seeing so far in that aspect?
Well, aside from my research, I work with an incredible young lady. She's my mentor, Nono Sekoto, and she is a young farmer. And there's an African Farmers Association, AFASA.
Okay.
And they look at South African farmers, black farmers, and trying to uplift them. So luckily, last year we had a conference, the first Black Young Farmers Conference, which was sponsored by Standard Bank and a whole lot of other sponsors. And we looked into the African black farmers that we have currently.
Yes.
And I think the challenge really is one, they want to grow. You know what I mean? They want to get out of where they are producing to a higher level of production. And that's not easy, because the time frame of farming and crop production is not the same time frame as business.
Absolutely.
Where you start a company for electricians or technology and you get profit now. Here you have to wait a whole year and see whether your stuff is working out. So it also becomes a difficult thing for bankers. So how do they give you money? What type of loan are we giving the farmers? Because you can't expect the same return for a farmer than someone who is in a normal corporate business.
Yes.
So we're seeing a trend in them wanting to grow into being large-scale farmers, or rather being their own enterprise and without depending and on the government money or whatever money, but standing on their own and becoming a business. That's the trend that we are seeing currently in young farmers. And
what's their biggest issue? Is it the climate issues, which obviously then impact on the ability to produce, or is it the demand side, where large scale food manufacturers or distributors are accessing their product? Where's the bigger challenge? Mm.
So one, it's land. We need access to land.
Okay.
And two, it's skills. So
I apologize because I'm cutting you short there.
No problem.
Is it possible to determine yourself a farmer if you don't actually have land to farm? I'm just trying to get.
Yeah, you can, because you can loan out land and you can rent out land.
I see.
Yeah,
okay.
So you can still, that's the same challenge that I'm saying, is that how do you make someone love with something they don't own?
Okay.
You know, how do you make a young person fall in love with this thing? You don't own it. It can get taken away from you in a minute.
Mm.
Checkpoint had a lovely segment on farm killings. Recently, actually, and it showed a white farmer who had owned this land, and he was just so greedy about it that he just took it away, or I don't remember the segment, but it just showed the dynamics of it, that now what am I doing, I'm farming in this land, but it doesn't belong to me. So yeah, you can be a farmer and not have land.
Okay, I've got you.
So it's a challenge of land, it's a challenge of skills. So we can't give you land, but now what am I doing? I don't have the skills in agriculture. And then it's also the challenge of technology. So to produce, large-scale farmers don't do it hand labor.
Absolutely.
They have irrigation systems that are running while you are in the office,
automated,
while you are talking
machinery,
other things.
Yes.
Exactly. This is what farmers need now. They need technology. They need financial capital investment, and they need technology. And they need training in managing that technology. If we can have those three combinations, then we can see maybe a change in how they produce food, in the amount of production that they're actually doing, making in their land. So just a simple exercise of tilling, tilling your soil. Just it's work. The challenge also is that it's not even young people. it's old gogo in the community that are farming. The young people are moving into cities now, are getting jobs. They're not seeing this whole important thing of land. So if you want people to fall in love with agriculture, you've got to introduce technology. You've got to give them technology. If the government says land with no
expropriation without compensation.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes. Then make sure that there's a starter pack of skills, and it's also that you give them technology access.
Mm.
Training on how do I get access to this technology. That's very important.
I want to then touch on something we spoke about earlier on the cue around technology. I mean, I asked you about, you know, that new irrigation method. I think it came from the Netherlands or from somewhere in Western Europe. And it's like, you know, they drip the water directly into the root system and it uses less water. And you were kind of skeptical to say, yes, obviously it's valid, but that there are steps before that, that we're missing within our ecosystem.
Mm. Yeah. So as I said, the technology is there, but I am very skeptical from jumping from level one to level 100, because we still have to deal with the literacy rates of our farmers. Okay. Just the literacy rates on understanding, you know, climate change. Just the literacy rates. Mm. Simple things. Mm. We still have satellite-free imagery that you can go online and it can kind of tell you this land is suitable, this land is not suitable. They don't have access to that, the farmers.
Sure.
So I wonder, who are you going to teach these skills to? And who's actually going to gain from them? Yes, you can have a combination of farmers, some that are literate. I hate the word illiterate, but people who are not as literate, you know.
Mm.
So how do you make sure that everyone is gaining the same value from this kind of technology? Because what it's going to do is increase the gap even more. Because the people who get it are going to get it. And then the people who don't get it are not going to get it. And they're going to be like, I see Zoyland and leave it.
Yeah.
And what it's just creating a bigger gap.
Mm.
And my challenge is, let us move gradually to it. You can introduce the technology, but before introducing it, we need to kind of prove to ourselves first that we can jump steps, you know. Firstly, who are our farmers? How do they, what do they want to do? What are the skills that they're lacking? What are the financial skills that they're lacking? What is finance? What is business? What is the farming enterprise? What is producing at a level of being market relevant and incorporating all these industries? Then introduce this kind of technology.
Mm.
Because you can't, it's too much. It's like jumping from first year to PhD. Impossible. It's too much skills that you need to know. You know what I mean? A lot of governments projects and some private company projects have tried to develop some kind of co-op system.
Oh, yeah.
Where they're saying co-ops, so we buy, you have a bigger amount of land and all of you guys in the community manage this land. Where are those projects?
Hmm.
Where are they?
Let me now ask a question that comes from with my technologist hat on. If I look at how technology has allowed us to leapfrog, you know, in certain industries, in certain spaces, and almost commoditized certain functions. So, you know, we know even in very technical fields, or previously technical fields, accounting, financial services, even in technology itself, you know, a lot of these things are now being done using things like artificial intelligence, using things like machines and robots and so forth. Is there not the answer for us, rather than trying to catch up and get all this learning, and it's just a question that comes to mind, is it not to apply technology to help us leapfrog some of the steps that we may have missed, so that we can actually yield the, you know, we can get the yield from the land, but at the same time we don't have to wait? Because my concern in the back of my head is, by the time we catch up, where will the rest of the world be, and won't we be left behind? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm always, what can I say? I fear being invaded by another country's way of method of applying it and then applying it to our country.
Okay.
I understand completely what you're saying, in the sense that it can make things quicker and make things faster, and we can just leap and jump into it. Leaping and jumping into it, most of the time what happens is that we fall behind, actually. We actually fall behind.
Okay.
So the first things first for me is, we actually need to own our own stuff. Because once people come in and say, here's a way of leaping, there is some kind of ownership that they're going to have from that leapage that you have.
Absolutely.
As an individual.
Yes.
So it's scary, and it's very, it's not something that I can say I'm guaranteeing and I'm saying, let us do it organically. No,
yes.
I'm not saying that at all. But what I'm saying is, let us start now incorporating those gaps before someone comes with the bigger knowledge and takes all of that, and we find ourselves in the same situation with good technology, but our farmers are still not gaining anything. You know what I mean?
Yes.
There's no way you're going to come with an irrigation system from the Netherlands that is amazing, and you're going to say, okay, 100% owned by you South African farmers. No. No, that's not owned by us. So what are we doing? You know what I mean?
Mm.
How about we try doing things our way? How about we try just our space and understanding this is what we're lacking, this is what we need, and this is where we need to grow. Just try that out and see if it works out. If it doesn't, okay. If this technology comes in because you're not aware of your own value as a country and comes in, you're gonna jump into it and say, yeah.
You're just gonna consume and consume.
Yeah, we want the technology. People are going to lose jobs. People are going to lose their own farming lands. People are going to start having to work in these machines. They're going to end up working to run these machines. Not that now they're working in their own land, you know. So I'm very
I guess skeptical. The message goes back to where we started, where we said that, you know, we need the science of experimenting with things, of playing, of researching to be driven so that we can then create our own systems that are very relevant to the work we do here. And in effect, I think what you're saying is we need to be exporting our machines and our technological advancements to the rest of the world and not consuming the whole time.
Yeah, no, it's for me, there's no excuse now for us to be consuming more than we can take out. There's no more. We have it in our hands as a country to do it. And now it's just about time that people start believing in these kind of in technologies that people have. I think I saw something on Facebook. I know it's not a legitimate site, but it was on Facebook where a young guy, I think his name is Unati, he had a water solution that he presented to Cape Town and he ended up being killed for it. Why then do we need, now they're using this kind of technology that he presented years ago. So my question is, why are we doubting ourselves?
Yeah.
We buy our local, we buy our own skills, we figure it out ourselves. That's how we should be thinking now as South Africans. And anyone who wants to come into the country needs to first understand that you're going to buy into it, and then we're going to see what you have to say, not the other way around. Because that's where exploitation happens. Quickly. Next thing, we've lost our land.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we consumed by it. Oh, it happened so quickly. They're smart. They know that, yeah, it happens quickly. You run the machine. We'll run this land. There's always a trade-off when it comes to these things. So we've got to know which trade-off do we not want to sacrifice.
Sacrifice. How do we then make it more accessible? You're a scientist, and I can tell you, even for me, it sounds very daunting. You know, this world, this research, you're talking about Python. I don't know if it's a snake or what. So, you know, how do we, because part of the success in this is in people spending countless hours researching things, studying things, testing things out. And I know you've got a foundation, which we're not going to get a lot of time to talk about today, but talking about women in science. But how do you start to make it more accessible so that we do have more scientists coming through the system and playing around with these things?
So first of all, we've got to work from our basic education, just basic education. The whole education system needs to just figure itself out, refresh itself in making sure that science technology is something that's tangible. It's not something that you read about. So access to labs, access to the technology. If we want to have technology from the Netherlands, fine, but you better have them in as a guest into the country and teach the kids on this is what a new irrigation system looks like, and they see it. So it's more tangible. It's more something I can relate to than something that I read and calculate in my own space. We've got to also sustain the ones that are in the industry. So the scientists that are in the industry that are now going to corporate because they're giving up. Research is daunting and it's exhausting.
Yes.
And how do we make them see their value in the bigger picture? So not just to say, oh, I just want to submit and go, you know?
Yes.
How about you start partnering these students with corporate companies that actually will use your information? You know what I mean? So making sure that they see themselves in a larger scale than what they are. Yes, there are scientists who just want to do the pure technical stuff and don't want to be a part of it, and they love it. But there are those scientists that just want to be relevant. They just want to see themselves and not say, I don't want to write this thing for years and then it just goes there and then I'm just empty, you know? So I think that we need to make more initiatives, and not just initiatives, but more funding into these, into research and innovation,
and proactively, not reactively when there's a crisis.
Yeah, more funding. There needs to be more funding, as much funding that there can be to science and technology, innovation and research. It should be there, because a black student has responsibilities at home. You're telling me after 9 years of study, now I have to go do my PhD. No, my mom expects a salary. My younger brothers are growing up. Mm. So fund these students and make sure that they are not stressed on top of what they're doing in the office. Mm. And also make it tangible and make it more relevant to them. And that's how we can kind of encourage more science.
Fantastic. Yeah. Me, before we wrap up, I mean, some thoughts from your side. It's been a very intriguing conversation. I see you're very attentive.
Yeah. I love agriculture. I think it's more a leadership issue as well. I mean, in Gauteng, they've introduced the one family, one hectare project, where they're looking to have families own, but not just own, produce, you know, on that, and then have the communities around there benefit from it.
Amazing.
I was talking to Land Bank a couple of months ago, and the biggest issue as well for them is skill. So there's a lot of farmers that they work with, but they loan them money, they work with them, but the skill is an issue. The passion also becomes an issue, because what happens is that they're not passionate enough to stay. So they're business people. You get some business people who just want to farm.
They think there's an opportunity.
Money. And then when it doesn't work out, because they don't have staying power, they don't know what's happening in the farm, it becomes an issue. The other thing, with you got a lot of corporates, multinationals, that are focusing on food security, like you said, but also water security. I mean, right now in water affairs, it's Western Cape that's number one. You've got the Eastern Cape next, Northern Cape, and then KZN. So they're now focusing on all those four to say, if we don't manage our water security right now, we're going to have a food security issue, right, in those four provinces. And those are the four provinces that have big land, right? So how do you make sure that small-scale farmers or emerging farmers are given the opportunity to actually use that land? So for me, it's number one, a leadership issue. If from a government, you get political buy-in from an agriculture perspective, and they're doing that now, right now. The problem is now they're focusing on money. They're not focusing on actually building emerging farmers to get to the point where they're able to, like, handle themselves and be able to do business by themselves. The biggest thing as well is market access. Mm-hmm. So you've got commercial farmers who have 20-year contracts with your ShopRites and your Pick and Pays. And the quality of the crop is also an issue, because the seedlings that they need to actually use don't produce the same quality that the ShopRites on your Pick and Pay. So how do you get there? You need to get black people to be funded to get those seedlings, to get the land, to be trained on how to basically take their crop to the market. So for me, it's an exciting thing. And I think we're going to be talking a lot about this moving forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. Ndoni, we're going to wrap up now.
Thank you so much.
A great conversation, but very quickly, two things from your side. Your vision for South Africa and for the continent in the context of the work that you do.
Mm. Ownership. That's my vision. Mm. Ownership. That's all I want. I want our farmers to get these skills and we test it out. We have not been given a fair advantage here. We need to own this and then be given the skills and given the same plate that every other farmer has received in our own country. So the goal that I have as a country is ownership and policy implementation and providing them with these skills.
Fantastic. And then the show is about disruption. And I mentioned it's not just about technological disruption, but really about doing things differently regardless of industry or context. How would you define it for yourself, disruption?
Well, disruption for me is to say, you're changing a system. You're changing the way that people view a certain thing. So just now we're talking about technology.
Yes.
I would say that if we change the view on how we view technology and saying that we're going to benefit from it, but rather they're going to benefit from us. So from seeing our own value and disrupting the way that you think and the way that you view that thing, that's disrupting an industry.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us on Disrupt with Mpumi Nhlapo. It's been another great conversation with another wonderful guest. To our sponsors, T-Systems, once again, for making the platform available. We are very grateful. And thank you for listening and tuning in. We'll be with you next week again on Disrupt with Mpumi. Have a wonderful day.
This is Disrupt with Mpumi Nhlapo, powered by T-Systems.
This is CliffCentral.com.